The work of this church in the world is realized through the generous financial support of all who call this place home. Along with the gifts and time and talent, ours is a shared ministry. You have a role to play here. Church membership is open to all. For more information, go to uusf.org.
Those of you who know me know we don't ever get to start with Easter without a step back in time. Because Easter doesn't make sense without a trip back in time, a couple of days in the story of this week, to the greatest misnomer of all holy days, Good Friday. Good Friday is always a fresh and relevant story. In June, it will be 30 years since I was ordained, and there has not been a year in those 30 years that we haven't lived in some Good Friday world somewhere, often somewhere close at home as part of the story. The story, after all, is about a particular event and a universal one, like all good stories. In this story, as I'm sure you all know, a beloved, cherished, sacred life, the life of a man named Jesus, someone who was good and spoke the truth and modeled a beautiful and courageous life, a divine life, was killed. And for all the wrong and hard-hearted reasons that human beings, with all our false gods and unexamined choices and brokenness and petty egos, find a way to destroy and reject what is good in the world so often when it shows up. We killed a holy and sacred life when it showed up among us, the story says, and the sky was rent that day. God had promised never to send any more floods after Noah, not to destroy humanity. And we are lucky on Good Friday that God keeps God's promises. I'm not sure we're always worthy of it. Anyhow, but this is an ancient story. It's old, it's dusty, it's irrelevant, it's kind of quaint, isn't it? I mean, is anything good in danger of being forsaken in 2025? Are there any mobs in our Jerusalems destroying what is good? Is anyone innocent being sentenced without due process? Or sent to be tortured by a king who loves power and lacks the humility to listen and heed legitimate criticism in order to be more worthy of the calling of leadership? The holy obligation of leadership? Is anyone or anything of value in danger of being trampled on because too many people do nothing? Good Friday worlds are hard places to live in, always, and sometimes more relevant than others in our human history. So, we can imagine the setting for today's part of the story. It's dawn. The sun is breaking, and with it, the Sabbath restrictions lift. And Mary Magdalene and another Mary, mother of James, perhaps, come with spices they've bought in the market to anoint the body of Jesus. They arrive at the cave where Jesus' body was laid in a rough tomb with a rock rolled across its entrance, I guess probably to keep animals out at night. And we can imagine that they come, as we even feel, full of searing grief at all they have witnessed and at a loss from which they will never fully recover. They come to do the only thing that they can for this person they have loved, this last act of love, to anoint the body for proper burial according to their tradition. And what do they find when they arrive? The rock has been rolled back, but the tomb is empty, just the fabric it was wrapped in left behind. Their first thought, as probably would be ours, is that the tomb was desecrated and robbed in one more intentional blow to their beloved. But we are told in the story that they see, depending on the version you read, one or two shining figures appear or present, and these angelic figures say that there is nothing to weep about, that the Jesus that they love lives on. In one gospel, in fact, Mary meets Jesus. In others, the disciples will meet him on the road to Emmaus or on a beach. Some of them will be told by a man how to catch fish by throwing the net into the waters, encouragement to keep going on and gathering food and nourishment for their people, for the people they will gather to them. And they know this person they meet, all of them, as the Jesus who was in the tomb. And in this tradition, the teachings and the movement behind this person and those who believed in him, it will go on, right? Despite future persecutions, teachings to love thy neighbor as thyself, to not cast the first stone, to forgive seven times, to challenge empire with truth, no matter the price. Moreover, people who live these teachings will say again and again that they have met this God, this prophet, this healer in their lives in infinite ways. They will speak of meeting him in prayer, in visions, with healing. King would hear the voice at his kitchen table in morning prayer. The morning he was one of many afraid for the life, and rightly so, of his family. This very church was built by people who held this story central as the anchor and one of the guiding north stars to their own life choices, to fight slavery, to fight for women's suffrage. In more recent times, to affirm the worth and dignity of all couples and all genders, to welcome and support asylum seekers fleeing violence, to serve our neighbors as we do again today, and navigate whatever it is that life brings us as we do again today. So Easter is the unbelievable story of resurrection against Good Friday's attempts to annihilate. And the bad news is that Good Friday repeats again and again through human history. And the good news is that so does Easter. What does that mean, Easter repeats? What is resurrection? What does it look like when it shows up in the world? Does it still? Perhaps because this is such a big holy day and holiday, I have to admit, I feel like I owe you all a big miracle story. I mean, another one besides the story of Jesus. But I think I want to steer another way. I mean, I also hope for big miracle stories. But I wonder if it's better for us to see resurrection in smaller places and everywhere. The Reverend Victoria Safford, meditating on resurrection years ago, goes first to nature, which of course is why Easter, which, whenever it did happen, was nonetheless scheduled in the Western Hemisphere to happen in springtime. Safford writes of resurrection, "Have you seen the trees? Have you seen the maple buds, the magnolias swelling, poplars, the first lacy pale sprays across the shoulder of the hills, the forsythia, and those three small flowering perfect crabapple trees in the park? Strong little trees begging children to climb them and get lost for a while in their magical pink canopies. Did you smell the rain this week and the muddy, ready earth receiving it? Did you smell the musty, lusty, moldy pile of leaves all thawed now and underneath the moist and living earthworms wide awake? Earth speaks to us of resurrection. God speaks to us through all God makes and moves through. Forest fires burn, and it is barely cool, and new shoots that had no sun to grow in a mature forest take that moment to claim life and make the world green again. Life will hear no, no. Dandelions push through the concrete streets as a reminder of what will not hear no. And there's more around us that speaks of resurrection. Safford asks, can we admit, however carefully at first, however foolish it may sound, that once or twice in our lives, perhaps over and over, tumbling over, we have seen events miraculous? Choose the word you will, whatever words you need. If miracle cloys, try unexpected, surprising, unanticipated, a second chance. Even that modest definition of resurrection opens a door we can walk through. Resurrection of spirit, of life, in the ways we feel it and know it. It's the moral equivalent, the human equivalent of the dandelion that comes through the concrete in the sidewalk. It's the person who came to me last week after service to share with me that they had ended a marriage they were absolutely sure was dead, but that she and her spouse had found their way back to each other, and they were more alive to one another than ever before. That's resurrection. Resurrection is every one of us and everyone we know who has wrestled with an addiction and remade a life, one that was responsible and made amends and then sponsors those who come behind them to remake their own lives. It's choosing forgiveness when we could hold a grudge and repeat the sins of our. It's every nation that has reclaimed lands torn apart by war and reached into the literal rubble to bury the dead and rebuild. It is every veteran who served and suffered the price of war and testifies loudly about the need to do peacemaking and avoid war. It is telling the truth about who we are, and every time telling a fuller version of our history that honors all the voices, all the truths that we carry in our bones and are accountable for. Resurrection is facing climate dangers and seeing if we can, doing what we can to turn things around so another generation inherits a place as beautiful or as close as we can come to the place we inherited. It is each time we go solar or build for wind or plug in an electric car or bike. It is seeing where we have let things go awry, and after we weep, rising up to march, to speak up, to risk as generations before us did, and go after the dream again, whether the dream was and is beloved community, the city on a hill, the lady who welcomes all who are tired and hungry and yearning to breathe free. A world where we are each for each other all the time, and where we get that that world is actually the most selfish world and vision we can live into, because we are happier when we live in a world where everyone is for each other. It is when those with money and power lead the way. Thank you, Harvard. And it is when those without money and power lead the way. It is us. And this isn't soft theology. We start at Good Friday, my friends, to remind ourselves of what a life asked of us long ago and might again, how it can ask everything of us, strip us raw. But we wear bonnets today because the Easter story with its resurrected God asks the listener to wake up to all that might happen, to all that is happening, to look for opportunity, to listen for the chance to lean in to life and its resurrection, to look at the worst moments in our shared history, in our own lives, and find divine love pushing through to be alive against all odds, and then participating in it in every way we can with every fiber of our being, being Easter people in a Good Friday world. And you and I, we will have to meet evil, as those before us have. And those who follow us will have to. We will have to be ready to meet it. Life is not a free pass from courage. It's not part of what we get. And let me say what you already know, that evil will have its victories. The old stories are clear and unambiguous on that point. Evil will have horrific and heartbreaking victories that numb the soul some days, that drop us to our knees. But we're called to remember, beloveds, that the ancient stories say also that those victories will not have the last word. That love is the reality that cannot be destroyed despite all efforts. That hope will burn through all dark nights and trying times and reignite the spirits of those who are faltering, including our own. And that we pay attention, because walking around with us all the time, we are told, is the power and presence of resurrection in nature, dropped into our hearts like grace some days, practiced until it is a habit like picking up our socks, common as mud, the poet says, chosen again and again. Resurrection can be a form of stubborn moral resistance. Resurrection like water on a rock that wears down what tries to, for no good reason, to take away from this life and from this world all that is beautiful and true and good. And in this world, love and liberation and mutuality and second chances, sweet like chocolate, are hidden all over us, all around us to find and to seize. Scattered on the saint and the sinner alike. Increasingly, I am convinced that we human beings, in the moral order of the universe, we are going to keep being sent as souls to this earth until we finally give in to the good, convinced that we cannot destroy it, even at our worst, that we are like children that are just determined to test our parents, afraid and hoping both that the love that is there for us is bigger than all we can throw at it, and needing to prove it to ourselves again and again, that love wins, and that we can lean into it and surrender to it. And for me, that's Easter's message, all of this. That is bonnet worthy, that into this Good Friday world go blessings of courage and hope, that we step into it with endurance and committed to be for each other, that we roll up our sleeves and roll back the rocks on what we've given up as dead in the world, in our hearts, and trust what endures against the odds is not evil, though it will try, but love, life liberated to love. And so I close with the words of Adrian Rich, who wrote, "My heart is moved by all I cannot save. So much has been destroyed. I have to cast my lot with those who, age after age, perversely, with no extraordinary power, reconstitute the world. Blessings, everybody. I love you. Happy Easter. Let us live resurrection. Amen."
On September 11th, 2001, I was in New York City co-sleeping with my newborn son, Max, when I was awakened by the sound of endless sirens. My husband, John, had already left for the morning. He was in the habit of meeting a friend for coffee at the top of the World Trade Center before heading to his office. On this particular Tuesday, John's friend, who also had a newborn son, had called to cancel their morning meeting because his baby had slept through the night for the very first time, and he wanted to enjoy breakfast with his wife. John's friend worked in the second tower. He arrived just as the first tower came down and was able to get away. Had it not been for a newborn baby sleeping in for the first time in his life, we would have been two more families forever altered by the events of the day. I've always been a fiercely self-motivated person. When I want something to happen, it almost always happens. But that attack plunged me into a sludge of thick grief, and no matter how hard I tried, I couldn't get myself out. I remember looking at Max and feeling guilty. I felt too sad, too small, too incompetent to be a mother. One evening, after days of sitting alone at home crying, out of desperation, students were sitting atop a sculpture of George Washington on his horse. They had covered it with flowers and hung a banner with a peace sign on the horse's chest. I noticed a brightly dressed young man zigzagging through the crowd, greeting random people. When he reached me, he looked me in the eyes and said, "You know, we're gonna be all right." He put something in my hand and left. It was a little purple heart made out of tissue paper. While I had been subsumed by grief, this young man, this gentle butterfly, had endured and had been pollinating the neighborhood with hope. I was overcome. I wondered what vital force had set him in motion. What instinct made him so able? What fueled his audacious clarity that kindness towards others? Kindness, delicate as tissue paper, can deliver us in the face of such wreckage. I remember some conversations back then reflecting on how it had taken the aggressors several years to plan the attack, but how it had only taken an instant for people in the towers to reach for each other's hands. I looked at my baby. He was calm amid the din. I remembered the first time I heard his hungry voice call out to me. I found a place to sit, took him out of the carriage, and held him close for a while, grateful to kiss his little head. Then I put him back in the carriage and headed toward a vigil.